You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. Today, we are talking about sleep, a really important issue. I'd like to welcome Dr. Lynelle Schneeberg to my program. Dr. Schneeberg is a pediatric sleep psychologist, an assistant professor at the Yale School of Medicine, and the director of the Behavioral Sleep Program at Connecticut Children's Medical Center. As a fellow of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, she is one of only about 200 board-certified sleep psychologists in the country. Dr. Schneeberg's book, Become Your Child's Sleep Coach, is targeted specifically at parents of school-aged children, specifically ages 3 to 8. Most sleep books are aimed at infants and toddlers, so this is a unique book, really helping parents of preschool children. Dr. Schneeberg, welcome to the program. I'm so happy to be spending this time with you.
Thank you so much for hosting me.
Of course. So in your book, you report that 80% of preschool parents say their kids have sleep issues. And because what's unique about this age is now kids are walking and talking, right? So as opposed to all the books that target infants and toddlers who aren't really on the move, this is a whole new set of problems when kids can get up out of bed or constantly call out. So what is causing these sleep issues and what are the common mistakes that parents make?
Yes. So I did find when I was thinking about whether to write a book about this, that all of the books that you see on the shelves for sleep training or sleep coaching all have baby's faces on the covers, right? They're all for little infants and toddlers. And children who are older have so many sleep issues. And I felt that there was really an unfilled, you know, niche for a book that's about kids who are a little bit older, like you say, preschool and elementary age. And at that age, what happens is a lot of the kids come out of their cribs, right, and into an independent sleeping situation in a toddler bed or a twin bed. And once they can do that, you don't have that crib anymore to keep them safe and contained. And so they can come out of their room to find you. They can come out of their room to come down the hall and you hear the little steps running towards your bed, you know, or you wake up with the child right next to you, you know, or wake up out of a dead sleep and there they are. So what parents often do, they do two things with the best of intentions, but these two things often make their children worse sleepers. And the two things are staying with a child until they're completely asleep. So sitting in the room, sitting on the bed, lying in the bed, maybe holding hands with the child, talking to the child until they're completely asleep. That's the first thing. And the second thing is they grant a lot of extra requests when the bedtime routine is supposed to be over. You know, so they finish reading time and say goodnight and try to head out of the room. And then their child has a million things that they want them to do. They want ice for the water. They want you to look under the bed. They want to hug mom one more time. They want to pet the dog. And they'll just kind of try to keep the party going as long as possible because kids love us, right? And they find going to sleep boring. And so they'll come up with a million reasons to keep things going. And so what I always talk to parents about when I meet with them are those two things. How are we going to help you get out of the room more and more, you know, bit by bit until your child can fall asleep independently? And what are we going to do about all those extra requests that your child makes after they are supposed to be going to sleep?
I know for me, I had a lot of sleep issues with my firstborn, and we went on vacation when he was about 14 months old, and we had a bed, no crib, and he slept through the night every night. And I thought, well, the answer is he's got to be in a bed. It's the crib.
Right.
And so we came home, bought him a bed, thinking that was the answer. And of course, you know, I think it was the exhaustion from playing on the beach all day that he was sleeping through the night.
Yes, and he was probably with you. You know what I mean? He was probably
in the same
sharing
room.
A bed. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So one of my favorite quotes that I've seen is, you know, what you just mentioned, at bedtime, children become thirsty philosophers who need a hug. You know, they're thirsty, they're hungry, they want to talk about who is God, why is death, you know,
they
all these
do.
Big, big questions. So you talk about callbacks and curtain calls and, you know, really guiding parents on dealing with these requests. So how do you suggest handling this?
Yeah. So I nicknamed those extra requests callbacks and curtain calls because I have three kids and my two girls do theater. And I just thought that was a great way to explain the way kids act after the lights out, right? They either call you back 100 times or they show up in the living room long after you thought they were asleep. And what I do for that particular issue is I have adopted a technique. I did not make this up. It's been around for a long time, and it's called the bedtime pass or the bedtime ticket. And when the routine is over, you just give your child one or two of these little tickets. They can be index cards that you've decorated. They can be poker chips. They can be anything you want. And you tell your child, you know, we're finished with reading. I'm going to give you a kiss and I'm going to head out. But if you need anything else from me, you can use one of these tickets. And then your child exchanges that ticket for one more dose of you, as if you will, right? So if they want to hug mom one more time, mom comes right back and gives a big hug and takes the ticket and leaves. And so your child has sort of two more opportunities to ask you for things, but not 17 more opportunities to ask you for things. And it's just a really simple, great exchange system for kids. And they understand they do have the opportunity to ask you for one or two more things. Maybe they did forget their stuffed giraffe in the basement playroom, you know, and they have a way to get that, but they know there's a limit.
And so how do you fade out of those tickets? How do you get them, you know, off that need for the callbacks?
Yeah, exactly. So just getting them down to two is often enough for most families because they've been doing way more than that. So getting them down to two is the goal. Another option for those tickets is to have a reward system. So in the morning, if the child did not use one of the two tickets or both of the tickets, they can exchange the ticket for some small reward. It could be something as simple as which snack to pack in their lunchbox or what kind of fruit to put in the pancakes, or it can be something really easy, an extra book at book time. So that's a nice way to fade them away if you'd like. And another system would be just to go from two down to one, or then to make a reward cost more than one ticket. And there's just a really simple way to fade it away over time.
And so often what happens with this is kids will get sick, or they'll be cutting new teeth, you know, 5 or 6 years old, and mom's, you're in the room with them and you're taking care of them, and then you have to kind of start this over again. Is there a quicker way to get back to what you've accomplished of not using these tickets, or is it kind of the whole process over again?
Yeah. Well, the other piece of the puzzle, right, is whether or not your child can fall asleep independently without you in the room at all. So I usually work on that first before I introduce the tickets. So for that piece, what you would do is you would have a routine, a really great routine with a really clear endpoint so that your child knows, oh, this is the last thing that mom or dad always does. They read two books, they kiss me on the forehead, and then they head out. And if the parent still has to stay in the room with the child, what you can do is begin to just make the parent moves slowly further and further away. So instead of being in the bed, you could sit in a chair and the chair's right next to the bed. And then that chair could be 2 feet from the bed, halfway to the door, in the door, halfway out the door, and that sort of thing. And at the very same time, you're offering the child a way to self-soothe with a little trick I've called the bedtime basket. And that would be a little basket of items kept at the bedside for the child. And that basket would have things like a coloring book, a picture book, you know, age appropriate, a drawing pad, little superhero figures, whatever is age appropriate for the child. And once you finish reading the two books and kissing them on the head, and you're heading out to sit in the spot that you've agreed upon, right? Maybe the chair's halfway to the door. Then when your child asks you for any attention, you would use the tickets for the first two things they ask you for. And then you would remind them, hey, you have a basket that you can use with a soft reading light until you're drowsy enough to go to sleep. And the parent would then be doing their own activity, right? Reading or working, listening to a podcast or whatever they might want to do. And then the child would be cued every time to use the basket until they're drowsy enough to fall asleep on their own. That's really the bigger goal, is to teach the child how to fall asleep using their own sort of quieting items rather than having a parent in the bed.
And what do you do about the child who kind of keeps the flashlight and after mom walks out, you know, puts the flashlight under the covers and is reading or doing something?
Yeah. Parents often ask me about that. And what I always say to them is whenever you're building a new pattern for a child, it takes them longer than it would once they really know how to do it. So if you're learning how to speak French, it takes you a long time to put a sentence together at first, right? So at first, it's really okay if the child reads for longer than you would hope as a parent. You know, you're always hoping for them to have lights out and go right to sleep. But when they're learning that self-soothing skill by reading themselves to sleep or drawing themselves to sleep, it might take a little bit longer. And I usually ask parents to just go with that for a while. You know, give it a good 2-3 weeks for them to understand how to use a basket to relax themselves to sleep rather than having the parent be the one who helps them do that.
So to recap some of that, you're creating a routine that's consistent. So reading books or doing a puzzle, whatever that is, your good night, hug and kiss. You're then giving them the tickets and then you're creating the basket, which is, you know, mom's no longer accessible. I might be sitting in the room, but I'm no longer accessible to you for attention and you need to turn to that. Are there other tips and tricks that are incorporated into that?
Yes. One more trick is to think about whether or not your child's room is exactly the same at 2 a.m. as it would be at bedtime. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. A lot of parents have purchased these special things for the bedroom, you know, in a wish to make the bedroom very cozy and comforting and relaxing. So they've purchased things like starlight projectors or music players or the sounds of the ocean, right? All these things. And they sound really lovely, but some of them turn off. Some of them turn off after 45 minutes to an hour. And so your child wakes up in a room where the stars are no longer shining and the ocean has gone away, right? And that room that they wake up in is quite a bit different than the one they went to sleep in, which would actually be disconcerting even to a parent, wouldn't it? You know, if you woke up and some sound was missing or a light was on that had been off. So one of the things I talk to parents about is preparing the bedroom before you start any of this work and making sure that the lighting stays the same, the sounds are the same, there's nothing that shuts off later. They're not relying on electronics to help their child fall asleep and those kinds of things just to get the room ready. So that's one more trick that I always work on with parents.
Could those things like the star projector and the sounds of the ocean, could that be just overstimulating? Or is what you're saying is if it's the same all day and all night, it's just their environment and that's okay?
It's just their environment. But I do remind parents that anything that happens in a child's room around bedtime becomes what we call a sleep crutch. So the biggest sleep crutch, you know, the thing that helps you fall asleep, is a parent often. But there can be smaller sleep crutches, like having the dog on the bed, or having the ocean sound, or having the starlight projecting. And the issue that I have, even if they stay on all night, is that nobody takes those things when they go to summer camp, right? You can't take the dog, you can't take the ocean, and you can't take the stars. And so you have these sleep crutches, maybe little ones, that are not very portable and that are missing. And they're missing in places that children often feel a little bit anxious about whether they'll be able to sleep there, like summer camp or a friend's house, a sleepover party, grandma's house, or anything like that. So I'm really in favor of a very simple room, just a dark, quiet room with a reading light, something to do until you're drowsy. And those are so portable, aren't they? You can take a book and a book light to camp or grandma's house or a friend's house for a sleepover. So I'm really a fan of sort of sweet and simple.
That's really great. I love that. I think that, you know, as you say, we don't think about that. And then you go on vacation, it's a whole new story. And then you've disrupted all the patterns for when you come home.
That's right.
For parents of children with developmental disabilities, autism, things like that, sleep can be a huge issue, especially autistic children often just don't sleep, have real problems sleeping. What suggestions do you have and how do you work with parents who are struggling with that?
Yes. So I work with a lot of children on the spectrum. That's really a specialty of mine. And children on the spectrum often really respond well, as you already know, to routine. So when I am working with them, I try to incorporate as much of the routine that they're already using into the patterns that I'm also designing for them, right? But the other thing that happens a lot with children on the spectrum is sometimes their sleep totals are shorter than a neurotypical child. So maybe they only sleep 6 or 7 hours, when possibly a neurotypical child might sleep 9 or 10. If that's true, then sometimes they have this really early bedtime, let's say 8 p.m. And then by 2 a.m., they're awake. And that's so hard for everyone, isn't it? Mom or dad are losing their sleep and the child is awake in a house that isn't as safe as it you know, normally would be. A 2 a.m. house is not, to me, as safe as a home when everyone's awake and alert and, you know, at their best. So what I'll do with kids on the spectrum is I'll have the parents make a sleep log for me for a good 2 weeks, and I'll see, are they sort of reliably sleeping for 6 or 7 hours, and where do those hours fall, and do they fall at a time that works for the family? And if they don't, then I'll do a little circadian, you know, re-entrainment where I'm moving the 7 hours, I'm turning the clock, if you will, and so maybe they're sleeping now from 11 to 6, which sounds sort of absurd to have a bedtime of 11. But it isn't if they only sleep 7 hours. And if I can match their hours to the parents' hours, everyone does better.
And we find this actually in aging adults and adults with dementia, the sleep patterns go completely. And so you see a lot of adults falling asleep at 6 or 7 at night.
Yes.
And then midnight, 1 o'clock, they're up for the rest of the night. So I would would apply the same logic and the same process.
I would. So, of course, that's called advanced sleep phase syndrome. And it's the opposite of the teenager syndrome, right, which is called delayed sleep phase syndrome. So for older adults who have that issue, we also employ some circadian entrainment techniques involving light exposure, a later meal, later physical activity, even a little dose of caffeine in the afternoon. Those four things always push the bedtime: caffeine, activity, sunlight, and a meal. And so we just try to use those things to our advantage to push their bedtime a little bit later.
So you mentioned teenagers, and I know, you know, one of the issues that parents struggle with a lot is school starts early, which doesn't match the teenage sleep cycle. Teenagers generally go to bed much later and should sleep much later, but our school system has them up very early in the morning. How do you help with teens getting enough sleep when they're up till 11, 12 at night doing homework because of the demands of school, and then trying to get up at 7 in the morning for a school start time?
That's something that every single person that works in the field of sleep has a strong opinion about. We all feel that, you know, systemically we should fix that, right? Elementary school children should be the ones going early, and teenagers should be the ones going later. For many reasons, that isn't always the case. So I do work, you know, behind the scenes with parent-teacher organizations and school boards and trying to get that to change. And during the pandemic, we have seen that kids who can log on later from home without having to ride the bus, they're all doing fantastically. So I think we've had a live experiment during the pandemic to see that, wow, we should be having these kids, you know, arrive at school later. And I hope that that will be one of the silver linings of the pandemic, is changing school start times might be a little bit easier now that parents have seen for themselves how great it can be. So when I work with an adolescent, I do the same sort of thing we talked about a moment ago. I do a 2-week sleep log, and I see, does their rise time vary by a lot from the weekends to the weekdays? And of course, it usually does. So they might have to get up at 6 for a school day, and then they might not get up until noon on the weekends. And when you shift your rise time by 6 hours, it's not going to be pretty, right? If you get up on Saturday and Sunday at noon and then try to go to sleep on Sunday night at 10 o'clock, you've only been awake 10 hours, and the body expects much more wake time than that. And that's why these kids go to sleep at 2 or 3 in the morning often. So we do usually a technique called school plus 2. And that means that I work with them to figure out what's the latest you could possibly get up on a school day and still make it to school, you know, iron out all the wrinkles in everything. Your clothes are ready. You have a breakfast you could eat on the road almost. You could, get up as late as you possibly could. And then we add 2 or 3 hours to that time. So let's say they could get up at 6:45 and still make it to school at 7:30. Let's call that 7 a.m. for the sake of argument. Then I would have them get up by 9 or 10 at the very latest on their days off rather than noon. And that shifting it less really, really helps them. Beyond that, I do, of course, try to get electronics out of the picture by a certain time at night and have them shift to reading regular books with a regular book light, if I possibly can. That's very hard, as anyone who has teenagers can tell you. Some people are motivated and some people really love to read. And if they will make that shift, they will definitely see the benefit.
So one of the challenges just on that topic is, I see it with my kids who are, you know, in college and juniors in high school. Now, of course, even with the pandemic, you're on your computer all day with remote learning, and then everything is computer driven for homework. So they're literally on their computers 18 hours a day. And then you've got the blue light factor. So, you know, it's challenging to get your kids off the computer when they're trying to finish homework, and homework is all computer based. So are there any techniques for combating all that blue light activity, all that exposure when, you know, they're kind of finishing homework and trying to go to sleep 30 minutes later?
Yes. So the blue light blocking glasses, right? The amber colored glasses, they're a real thing and they do help. They really do help. So you can use night mode on your devices or F.lux filters or the amber colored glasses. And those do absolutely help. And even if you can help your teenager get into bed with just a half an hour to spare to switch off of screens and onto something like a book with a book light, even those small changes make some difference.
Great. That's very helpful. What about adults? We know that adults also have significant sleep issues, especially in this era of social media, working from home, and just how globally connected we are all the time, that, you know, people are just up and working and accessible. What recommendations do you have for parents and just adults in general?
Yeah. So they're fairly simple, but they're recommendations that not everyone follows. So having a sleep schedule that doesn't change much from weekdays to weekends, even for parents, even for adults. So having a rise time that you really do stick to no matter what is huge and really important. And your body loves that. Your body really loves and thrives with a very consistent rise time. And then when you do get in bed, it's fine to, again, read or have something that you can do to quiet your mind down while you're waiting to get drowsy. Some people get in bed early, hoping to fall asleep early, but that's sort of like going to the dinner table and waiting to get hungry. You know, you go to the dinner
that's
table.
That's a good analogy.
It's a great one. I stole that from Matthew Walker, who wrote a wonderful book called Why We Sleep. And so what you can do is, you know, you have a nice bedtime routine, which again, as a psychologist, you know, that will help you cue drowsiness. If you do the same thing in the same order, starting at the same time every night, your body will say, oh, that's what she does. That's what she does when she's ready to go to sleep. And drowsiness will begin to be cued very reliably. And then you climb in bed, maybe with a cup of herb tea in your book, and read to really quiet your mind. Then when you're really, really drowsy, putting the book down and dropping off to sleep.
And so I would assume you don't recommend having TV in the bedroom, watching TV. You recommend keeping the bedroom as a place for specific activities, but not working in bed, not, you know, things like that confuse the brain.
Yeah. Yes. It should be your sanctuary, right? But reading, I'm a huge fan. And I love the e-readers on the night setting. You know, you can have a multiple amounts of books, whatever you might be in the mood to read. And there it is right there on, you know, 20 books right there in your hand with a nice soft light. So I love those e-readers.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Schneeberg. Your recommendations for everything from preschoolers all the way to the elderly with sleep patterns have been incredibly helpful. And I really appreciate you taking the time to spend with me and share your wisdom.
I enjoyed it so much. Thanks for talking about sleep. Such an important topic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Renit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.